I would like to welcome you to the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services, and this is February 26th. And I will start in with opening a work session on Senate Bill 384. Sandy, would you remind us about this bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 384, we had a public hearing on this on the 18th of February. This requires the Oregon Health Authority to prescribe criteria for training on treatment of opioid overdose and specifies those training requirements. It allows the person who successfully completes training to possess and administer naloxone for treatment of opiate overdose. This has an emergency clause. It's effective on passage. You should have a fiscal impact statement on the dash threes. We do have the dash threes, which clarifies that the health authority's role at increases oversight at the local level. It also authorizes persons who prescribes and dispense naloxone can distribute the naloxone to the trainees directly or to the trainers who will distribute to the trainees.
Great. And since we passed the bill, the emergency doctors were concerned, and so I'd like to invite Jim Anderson, who represents them, and then Dr. Oxman, Gary Oxman, because I think they've been collaborating a little bit on this, but I still want all of this on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Anderson with the Oregon Emergency Physicians. Again, thank you for taking the time to allow us to put on the record our concerns about this issue. I had first approached you for the possibility of a four-year sunset on this, and since then, since talking to Multnomah County, Dr. Oxman, and others, we have pulled back on that. However, at the outset, I'd like to say that we will continue to monitor this because we do get a number of patients who have overdosed into the emergency departments, of course, and we see this on a regular basis, unfortunately on an increasing basis. But it's difficult to address issues like this that with the certainty of the passage of this bill, because this is a very gray area in healthcare. And it's, we understand with the testimony that was given last week that these people feel very frustrated when they cannot administer to a loved one or a friend who has overdosed. And it's something we truly do understand. So we understand the need for the training and the reasoning behind this bill. This Narcan, or naloxone, is a very powerful drug. And it's a drug that at times first responders, EMTs, are hesitant to use because of the reaction that the patient demonstrates once the drug is administered. The emergency physicians do give this in small dosages. They expect in the hands of the general public it probably be 0.4, maybe 0.2 milligrams. At times we will give as high as 2 milligrams. One large dose can cause very unusual and unwanted side effects, and as long as this is part of the training and the people know going in that once they administer the drug, it could possibly cause a side effect that they're not ready to accept. And that's where an EMT or the emergency first responders would hopefully be called and help with the situation. Again, I'd like to thank Dr. Oxman and the folks from Multnomah County for helping us out on this. We wanted to put our concerns on the record, and we've done so. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Oxman, could you respond to some of the concerns that have been raised by the physicians?
Certainly, Gary Oxman, a public health physician, until recently a health officer with Multnomah County. Yes, there certainly there are some potential side effects of naloxone administration. One is what we call rebound, meaning that naloxone has a relatively short duration of action. So someone can overdose, and at least in theory, if they take a drug that has a longer duration of action than naloxone, their overdose can come back later. People can also, and I think this is the reaction that Mr. Anderson was talking about, people when they're given a large dose of naloxone, particularly if it's given intravenously shot into a vein, they can become extremely agitated and extremely uncomfortable very rapidly, and that does create a potentially dangerous situation. And finally, there are uncommon heart and lung complications of giving the drug. So it's not, you know, no medication is without its side effects. However, when you start really looking at the scientific literature on this, the issue of rebound, for example, it occurs in the order of once in every several hundred cases. So it's quite uncommon. Secondly, the agitation, that's seen primarily when the drug is given intravenously, shot into a vein, and it has a very rapid onset of action. In the community programs for naloxone administration, it would be given preferably by spraying it into the nose, a mist into the nose. It has a much gentler, softer onset of action, so you tend not to see that sort of agitation. Or even when it's shot into a muscle, you don't see that kind of agitation, or you rarely see it. And I think some of it is just the way the drug is given. I think the other important thing is that the training for this, item number one on the training is when you come across somebody who you think is having an overdose, call 911 is the bottom line. And that's number one. And then it's rescue breathing. And then if that doesn't work, you get on down the line to naloxone. So naloxone is not the immediate reaction. And I think the experience in most communities has been that you can successfully train lay people to maintain that sequence. I think it certainly there are legitimate concerns that come up, and rarely bad things will happen as a result of people intervening in overdose. But I think we need to put that against the context of what's happening now. And in 2011, 322 Oregonians died of opiate overdose death, and that happened in the face of statewide excellent emergency departments, good quality and aggressive EMS services throughout the state. And so in some senses, our systems, as good as they are, failed those 322 people. And so this is another layer of treatment that goes on top of what already exists here in the community. So I hope that makes sense.
Thank you. Yes. Dr. Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the concerns, Mr. Anderson, that the emergency physicians have raised. I guess the question that I would ask, I'll direct this to Dr. Oxman, since I don't expect you to be able to answer it, is if you look at the risk-balance ratio comparing naloxone with epinephrine, which is another very potent drug that can have significant adverse effects, but that we have already established a program for letting lay people administer in the face of anaphylactic reaction, how bad are the risks of administering naloxone if it's done appropriately with appropriate training, in appropriate doses, with an appropriate delivery route, compared to those of epinephrine?
Yeah.
Which is an equally life-threatening condition.
Yeah. Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Steiner-Hayward, naloxone, I believe, is a much more benign drug, much safer drug to give than epinephrine. When I was a child, I had the experience of receiving epinephrine for a bee sting reaction. And it, even being a young, healthy kid, it was a very unpleasant experience. And certainly epinephrine does have a tendency to induce cardiac arrhythmias, irregular heartbeat, and sometimes very dangerous irregular heartbeat. So the short answer to your question, epinephrine is a much more dangerous drug, and yet is still, it's absolutely essential for the treatment of severe allergic reaction.
Thank you.
Other comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd just say, and there may be some occasional uncomfortable reactions to this, but I think personally I'd rather be uncomfortable than dead. So, I mean.
I just think as long as, when we teach patients and their families about using epinephrine, it's very clear that the first is call 911,
right.
Then give the epi, then call 911 again. Which is to say, even if they respond appropriately to the emergent treatment, administered by the layperson, that does not obviate the necessity to get EMS involved and get them to definitive medical care. And it should not for naloxone either. And I understand that there are different social judgment issues around opiate overdose, but opiate overdoses are making their ways to the emergency department anyway. So let's get them there alive, in my opinion.
Any other further comments? Thank you very much, gentlemen. And we're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 3.
Oh, you need to stay here. Dr. Oxman needs to stay. Go ahead, Senator Cruz.
Let me start over without such a rude interruption. I didn't mean that. I move the dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 384.
Thank you. Senator Cruz moves the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 384. Is there any discussion? We do have the fiscal on that, and I would like to have Dr. Oxman explain the fiscal. As you see, if you read it, should be in your packet, committee. The health authority has issued a fiscal impact on this as indeterminate. But then in the next paragraph, fiscal came back saying the bill is silent on the entity responsible for the development, implementation, and monitoring of trainings on life-saving treatments for opiate overdose. And it does not stipulate the enforcement authority of or guidelines. So I'd like Dr. Oxman to explain to us why this doesn't have a fiscal when you have to come up with, you know, the development and implementation of the training.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, the bill as it's written authorizes public health agencies and other community-based organizations who serve drug users to do the training. It does not require anyone to do that training. It's entirely voluntary on the part of those organizations. It is true that the health authority will have some activity to undertake in this in terms of developing a set of standards for training protocols and potentially approving protocols, and that's something and they'll also need to participate in a rulemaking process.
Okay. So Tom Burns, let's ask, since Tom Burns is responsible for the fiscal, he needs to come up here.
Okay. Tried to stay away.
I know, you said you didn't want to come up.
We had a bow tie deficit, you had to come up.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. This bill requires us to craft rules, and that's about it. It does say that the rules have to contain certain things. Quite frankly, we're going to look to this gentleman right here to basically do all the work, and then we're going to go through our normal rules process and put it together and come up with it. We're not the experts in this. We don't pretend to be the experts. So our cost, as we saw it, was only the cost of doing a rules hearing and going through that process, which is an administrative process we do day after day after day. So that's why we saw no fiscal.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, correct me if I'm wrong. There are other states that have these protocols, so we aren't inventing something brand new here.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, there are at least 188 such programs out in the country, and they are we have a lot of their programs and a lot of their protocols in hand already, so this is not something that we need to make up from scratch. And, to comment on Mr. Burns' comment, yes, I personally will commit to participating in this, and there are many other advocates in the community who will lend their energy and their goodwill.
Great. All right. I just wanted get all of that on the record, and is there any other discussion on the dash 3 amendments? Is there any opposition to the dash 3 amendments? Then the dash 3 amendments is adopted into the bill.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 384 as amended by the dash 3 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 384 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Heward?
Aye.
Senator Snow?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chairman?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Bates will carry this bill. With that, thank you, gentlemen, and
thank you.
I will close the work session on Senate Bill 384 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 437. And I think Dr. Steiner Hayward would like to talk first. And then Pamela Colby can certainly come up also.
She's on the phone.
She's on the phone, and I think we've got somebody else. Is the other person on the phone as well?
I didn't have time to check, Senator,
okay.
But
we'll get there when we get there. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. I'm the state senator for District 17, and I'm also a family physician. Senate Bill 437 seeks to remedy two different issues relating to out-of-network insurance. Currently, most insurance plans are set up that if you choose an in-network provider, somebody who's already got a contract with that insurance company, you have to pay a very different amount. You pay a lower copay, you pay a lower percentage, things like that. But if you choose an out-of-network provider, those numbers go up substantially. The vast majority of the time, most consumers know to pick in-network providers. They make deliberate choices of the providers to see the facilities where they seek care to make sure they are receiving care from in-network providers. However, there are some situations in which patients have very little control and about who they choose. And this issue was brought to my attention by the insurance division, and I thought it was important to bring it to the attention of the legislature to see if we could figure out a plan to help solve some of the problems. The first situation is emergency care. Currently under Oregon law, if you have an accident or an acute serious illness and need emergency medical services, you could be required to pay more out of pocket if the EMS services we were just talking about take you to a hospital or facility that's out of your network without your knowledge. If you're unconscious, you can't say, please take me to this hospital rather than that hospital. And obviously you want to go to the closest facility that can provide adequate care. But you often don't have a choice. It also may be that the hospital itself is in your network, so some of the costs are covered at an in-network rate, but some of the various physicians or other providers who are involved in your care are not on your network. And again, you don't have much of a choice in that situation. The second is a non-emergency situation. Imagine for a moment that a patient needs to have surgery. That's elective surgery, non-emergent, and they carefully choose an in-network surgeon and an in-network hospital, but they go there and without any forewarning, it turns out that the anesthesiologist is not in-network and they weren't aware of that ahead of time. And they end up getting this astronomical bill that they had no expectation of doing, having done all their due diligence to make sure that they were picking an in-network surgeon and in-network hospital. The other situation, for example, is if I have a patient come to me and I were to take a lump or bump off of their arm and send it to pathology, it might be, especially if I were in private practice, that the pathologist to whom I sent that wouldn't be an in-network provider for that insurance. And I might not even know that as the primary care physician, so I might not be making a choice deliberately to send it to an out-of-network provider, and the patient certainly wouldn't be making a choice. So Senate Bill 437 will do two things, and again, I don't know that this bill is perfect as it's currently written, but I do think that we need to work on it and see what we can figure out to address this concern. And you'll be hearing from two people about how this situation affected them. In emergency situations, it's going to require insurers to reimburse for out-of-network emergency service providers at the same rate as in-network emergency service providers. And the insurance payment must be accepted as payment in full, and the provider may not seek reimbursement from the patient. In non-emergency situations, it requires non-emergency healthcare facilities to use in-network providers first. And if in-network providers are not available, the facility must notify the patient in advance that the provider is out of network, what the estimated out-of-cost pockets for the enrollee would be, the right to decline service to be provided from out-of-network providers, and to notify DCBS that this is happening. This is a situation that's affecting people across the state, and we have at least one, if not two, people on the phone, Pamela Colby from Astoria and Barry Cantrell from Hood River, who would like to share their experiences with you. I know Pamela's on the phone. Is Barry, are you on the phone as well?
All right. Who is on the phone right now?
Barry Cantrell.
Barry Cantrell.
Pamela. Mm-hmm. Pamela Colby.
Okay. Who do you want to go first?
Doesn't matter to me.
So would you please, one of you, introduce yourself, and we're here to hear your testimony.
Okay. My name is Barry Cantrell. I'm a small business owner in Hood River, Oregon, and I had a major accident. I fell off a ladder. I was life-flighted to Emmanuel Hospital, and I was unconscious. I was in their ER room for 2.5 days, and then I was moved downstairs to their trauma center. And once I finally got home, I started getting thousands of dollars worth of bills because part of the hospital was an in-network provider. Part of the hospital was an out-of-network. The doctors that were working on me, some of them were out-of-network. Even the nurses were out-of-network. And my insurance company refused to pay for them. And I was unconscious. I couldn't make any choices myself.
Thank you very, very much. And you're doing okay now?
I'm doing fine now.
Okay, good. Thank you. Pamela?
My name is Pamela Colby. I'm a mother of 5 children, and I've worked for the past 20 years in the field of serving adults with developmental disabilities. And along my road in life, I've learned through trial and error that many valuable lessons. One important lesson is to always do my best to make responsible choices for my family and myself. One night I became very ill at 1 a.m. and went to my preferred provider hospital emergency room. I was admitted to the hospital, and I woke up the next morning to discover I was in the critical care unit. Thankfully, I was treated successfully and released later that afternoon. Nothing could have prepared me, though, for what came later. I began receiving the customary insurance statements and bills from my hospital stay. However, several of the bills stated that my insurance had denied coverage. After many phone calls to the insurance company and billing departments at the various providers, my answer finally came. And much to my surprise and dismay, I discovered that even though I had done everything right by going to my preferred provider hospital, the doctor, the pathologist, and the imaging providers were not on the preferred provider list, and therefore 100% of their bills were not covered by my insurance. Consequently, I found myself with a debt that put my finances in a precarious position. I was lucky that the next year I had no other even small emergency arise, or it may have tipped my financial scales. I was trying to meet my regular living expenses while paying $300 plus a month in medical bills. And I was fortunate I was only in critical care for one day. Afterward, I kept thinking about the impact it may have had on my life if my hospital stay was longer than one day. And what impact was this having on others that weren't as fortunate as I was? At our very next insurance open enrollment meeting, I asked the insurance agents to explain to all employees present that they were not necessarily covered by going to a preferred provider hospital, and there was not a single person in the room who knew these facts until it was brought to light. This bill will impact many who find themselves in my situation, those of us trying to make responsible, informed decisions about our health care. And this bill would ensure that when your choice and your voice are unable to be heard due to an injury or illness, the coverage you pay for will actually help protect you instead of bankrupt you. I would like to thank the committee and the chair, Mona Anderson, for hearing SB 437, and Senator Steiner Hayward for sponsoring this important legislation. And I respectfully ask that you support it for all citizens of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you so very much for sharing your stories. I have some technical questions. I think we all understand what the issue is.
With your permission, then, Chair Monis Anderson, I'd like to invite Lou Savage to join me since he, from the insurance division.
Thank you.
Since he's probably better equipped to cope with the technical questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Savage.
I may be equipped to handle the technical questions. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lou Savage, Oregon Insurance Division.
Thank you. There's a reason for insurance companies to come up with an in-network and out-of-network provider plan for people. I know. I mean, we all do that because we have to. I don't have a choice. I always make sure that my providers are in a network. And I think there's even a provision with some plans regarding out-of-network. So tell me a little bit about the reason for having out-of-network and in-network providers right now. Why do insurance companies have them?
Oh, just Madam Chair, are you talking about the financial aspects of that? Well, I think that, and there are plenty of insurers in the room who would probably want to...
no one signed up, so
okay.
That's why.
the principle is that if you have a smaller population of providers, the financial arrangements you can make with them are more advantageous because they are, I wouldn't say guaranteed, but they are likely to have a bigger population of patients from that, who are covered by that insurer. So, for example, if you had, 50 OBGYN docs in a particular community, as opposed to 100, those OBGYN docs and the doc here can verify that, but those folks would likely take a contract that is more affordable for the insurer. So it's really a financial decision on the part of the insurer, mm-hmm. And then that would translate to a lower premium for the consumer.
Okay. So the reason is to hopefully provide a lower premium is why they do this. Because the first part of the bill requires the rate to be paid to out-of-network providers to be the same as in-network providers. So that's one.
Only under very specific circumstances, Madam Chair.
Yes.
When the patient really didn't have much of a choice about coming in and... isn't able to make any requests to do this. I mean, under the circumstances that both Ms. Colby and Mr. Cantrell described, they really didn't have any opportunity to have a say in who provided their care.
Right, and I'm not sure that's well defined, but that's one issue. The other is. In number three, on line 28, where it's my understanding that if a provider doesn't receive payment, they then can charge the hospital the balance that they don't receive. It seems like that's a part of this bill too.
I'm puzzled by why that would be the case. I see. It says on the next page, line one on page two.
That's right.
That part I certainly don't feel strongly about. But I do think, I understand the challenges, Madam Chair, faced by hospitals where if the physicians are not their direct employees, it can be hard for them to know exactly who's on which network and who's not. And as I said when I began my testimony, I'm not saying that Senate Bill 437 is in perfect shape at the moment. So I'm certainly willing to entertain amendments. And this may be one of the places that we need to adjust. But I do think that some awareness on the part of hospitals and some work with their providers to have some understanding of who's available. I mean, if you have two physicians on in the emergency department on a given night and one of them is on Blue Cross Blue Shield or ODS or pick your plan of choice and the other one isn't, then it seems reasonable, if possible, to have the physician who is in network provide care to people on that insurance plan if it's possible. And if it's not, then somebody ought to be thinking about how we protect consumers who are trying to do the right thing and are trying to be responsible, as Ms. Colby said.
Are you suggesting this is really a consumer protection issue, Senator?
I think it is, Madam Chair.
It came to this committee, though, unfortunately.
I mean, I was...
Days young, though.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I was actually
surprised that it didn't end up in front of your committee, sir. But I mean, I'm happy to have it here. Don't get me wrong. But I intended this as a consumer protection bill because I do think that that's what it is. I really do think that there are people like Ms. Colby who are trying to make responsible mm-hmm. choices and comply with the terms of their insurance plan, but then have that choice taken out of their hands. And that's my concern. And that's the concern that was brought to my attention by Mr. Savage and his colleagues after hearing about stories like the two that we've heard today.
Okay, so that's the second issue. I mean, I see this in three parts. The pain in and out providers the same, and then provide, you know, the hospitals eat what the providers don't get. And then the second one starts on page 2, right, line 5 through 20, where the hospitals must then let should let everyone know what the whole costs of the bills will be within a certain amount of time. And again, the hospitals haven't signed up to testify, or the insurers haven't signed up to testify on this bill. And I really think it's important for us to understand the ramifications of this particular bill. I understand the situation that Mr. Colby and Ms. Colby and Mr. Cantrell had, but I truly believe that we need some input from the people that this bill will impact and know the ramifications of that.
Madam Chair, the other thing I think I should mention is that the Affordable Care Act does address some of these issues, and one of the things we ought to do is line up the language in this bill with the language in the Affordable Care Act.
Because it's my understanding that this is only for commercial insurance. Is that correct? Well, Patty O'Sullivan, will you come up here to maybe say something from the hospital's point of view?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I represent the Hospital Association. And, Senator, a lot of the concerns that you're talking about right now are the same concerns we have. There was a similar bill, different yet similar, that Representative Boone had introduced, and it had one hearing, and there was also a constituent of hers that testified. And then a lot of us met with Representative Boone after, and she graciously is going to kill the bill, and because the bill really didn't take care of the problem. And I see possibly part of this being the same problem, and that is that different people have different types of policies, and it kind of is dependent on how much you pay when you have private. I pay for my own insurance, and so I pay a lot. But if somebody pays a third of what I pay, they're not going to get the same things covered. And that was the problem with Representative Boone's bill. I don't know if that's the problem with either of these constituents. However, I did note something that Mr. Cantrell said, that he went into Legacy. They had shipped him over to Legacy, and he was in one department, and that was covered, but then he went down to trauma. And actually, that was the same issue with Representative Boone's constituent, and that is that her insurance coverage covered emergency care, but when you go to the trauma, we only have two trauma hospitals in this state. One is OHSU and one is Legacy. In the trauma units, where you send people that are extremely seriously injured and sick, mostly injured, a lot of them are unconscious and they get sent there life flighted or by ambulance or whatever. That billing and those costs are very different than an emergency room, very different than a regular inpatient bed. And I'm just wondering what his insurance covered. Hers did not cover trauma, but did cover emergency. So it was one of those issues. To the bill itself, I believe the ACA language is going to take care of that first part. However, they have not adopted rules yet, so I'd be very cautious about aligning something with ACA law that hasn't been interpreted in federal rule yet. And then, of course, the part you mentioned at the top of page 2 that says that Well, the bottom of page one, it says that neither doctors or providers nor hospitals can balance bill, which means that if there's money that nobody, the insurance or the copay doesn't pay, we can't bill the patient. You can't do that in Medicaid, but that's because those people are very poor and they're very vulnerable. That's not always the case with other folks. So it says we can't balance bill, but then the top of page two says that since they can't balance bill, the docs can bill us, the hospital, and we're somehow responsible for paying the doctor's balance of their bill. No, so nor did we get funding to pay our balance, but now we have to pay their balance. So it's I'm not really sure what the purpose of that was. And then the next part, paren 4, lines 5 to 14, that is notification of non-emergent, but I've heard it testify something about we should let people in the hospital that are there for emergency know. Just want to let you know that EMTALA actually prohibits us from talking about finances with anybody who comes in for emergency care. We're there to care for them, not talk about what they're covered under and what they're not. But for non-emergent, which would be elective surgery, of course, if a doctor works in our hospital, and Mr. Savage mentioned 50 OBs, they have their patients out there, they have their own business, they do their own billing, and then they have the rights to come in and, you know, deliver babies in our hospital. They all have the right to deliver babies in our hospital. We wouldn't keep some out because they're not in the plan, because the plan is dozens of plans. We're not the plan. We're a hospital who joins plans. So for us to know what everybody else's insurance coverage is, we would not even know it. They bill separately. They join plans and don't join plans, and we don't know that information. We either employ our own doctors or we give them privileges. So that piece would be pretty cost prohibitive for us to have to survey everybody that's doing patient care on any given case, because we don't know what they're coming in for, what they're going to find out in the middle of even electric surgery for a knee replacement. They could go into cardiac arrest. We can't give an estimate. It could be from $1,000 to $75,000. We don't really know. And nor would we'd have to go find out. And then just the last piece on the reporting to the department, I guess my question there is why. What are they going to do with these stats? We report everything to everybody. I don't know. You know, this is yet another database, yet another reporting. I don't see any reason here. What would they do with that data? And then the second piece is it doesn't seem very, compliant with the Administrative Simplification Act that was passed last session for state agencies. With that, I'll take any questions. I am not an expert on billing, so these are just the thoughts off the top of my head.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that this is emblematic of kind of the Byzantine nature of our contracting and fee-for-service system, whereby one provider on one side of the street can charge or earn three times the price as a provider on the other side of the street who doesn't have as many providers and doesn't have the leverage in the marketplace. In this particular instance, it appears to me that a lot of what has been happening, and I'd like your comment on this, Patty, is that even in the emergency room, the actual physicians doing the emergency work right there in the ER are no longer often employees of the hospital, but they are LLCs of their own corporation that then go out and contract. And I don't know what the answer is, but it seems to me that if you put yourself out as a hospital, you put your name over it, somebody drives in through the ER, somehow you've got to be responsible for the people that you have working for you. So it almost seems like an issue of contracting out services and then pulling back away from the responsibility from fair pricing of those services. Am I on the wrong track there?
Well, Senator Mona Anderson, Senator Shields, I actually think that we actually employ more physicians today than we ever have. And, we're a hospital, we're not a plan. And so we don't sign them up on the plan. They come to us, and if they're credentialing, is good, and they go through all the hoops they have to. We give them privileges to you know, practice in our hospital, what insurance company they choose to contract with, should we, you know, I mean, it's a facetious question, but do we require them to be on contract with everybody, that every insurance company in Oregon, or what about out-of-state people? Or it's just not something that we, that's not part of our credentialing. We look at their, you know, their practice, where they went to school, where they, what kind of degrees they have, are they able to do the work that we contract with them for, not what insurance carriers they contract with. We contract with insurance carriers, and probably pretty much, I just want to say one thing. I think that somehow I work so much with Medicaid that this is a little different for me. And sometimes I'm thinking CCO, and that would be a very valid question for CCOs, but not, I think, on the commercial side, because it's a kind of a more of a free enterprise out there. They're their own bosses unless they're employed by us.
That follow-up. Well, I think, I mean, I understand there's varying degrees of this question. So it's one thing, and I'd like, you know, the big hospital systems to either provide to the staff at some point. Is the general operation of an emergency room contracted out to a group of physicians to run the ER on a regular basis, or are there kind of staff physicians for a hospital and then specialists come in on an as-needed basis? I think it's one thing for a patient to say, I want, call Dr. X and have them come in and do the procedure, versus this is the person that Providence contracts with for 16 out of 24 hours every day, mm-hmm. and that they're the company who actually runs it. I think that the hospital should have some degree of responsibility for the contractor who's there 16 out of 24 hours a day, maybe not quite as much for the person who's called in by the particular patient. Does that make sense?
Chair Bonus Anderson, Senator Shields, I kind of see where you're going, but I think for every hospital, it would be a different story. And some tend to, I mean, if you go way over to Eastern Oregon, they're lucky if they can get a true ED doc. And usually people bring their own physician in, and, you know, they call their own doc, like in the old days where I'll meet you at the emergency room. Then the bigger you get, the trend these days is a lot of doctors, family docs don't want to go to the emergency room in the middle of the night. That's why hospitals have gone more towards hospitalists and employees. So I don't think I'm answering your question, but that, to me, I think they're just, everyone is going to be a different answer to your question, whether they employ or don't employ, and why they employ or don't employ.
Madam Chair, could you kind of run that up the flagpole of the bigger hospital systems, and so we can get a sense of what's happening in their emergency rooms? Because this might not even be a real issue for most mm-hmm. hospitals. And if that is the case, if they're, you know, all, if most ER rooms are run by staff, then it's more mm-hmm. of a non-issue.
I can give it a try, definitely. And just to close, I think that every situation is different. And in some cases, hospitals can't get people to contract with them, certain docs, neurologists, neurosurgeons. So sometimes we're not really talking just about the doctor you see when you get there, who does sort of your screening and diagnosis. But, you know, then you have experts come in. You have, you know, docs at a higher level that you want to open your brain up and save your life. And they're going to cost more, and they're going to bill separately. And if they don't want to contract us, we still have to call them in. And there's only so many of them to go around. So this it's just a kind of a slippery slope on how this all works. And I'm not an expert, like I said, so I don't know.
I appreciate your effort.
But I will get some information back to you.
Thank you. So there seems to be some issues, not ready for prime time yet, but issues regarding notifying DCBS, which is 15 through 20, and then on page 2 lines, and then knowing all of the costs ahead of time, a health facility shall, you know, provide this information, which we're getting from the hospitals, that's an issue. And then the hospital having to, they can't balance, if they can't balance the bill, then the hospital needs to provide payment to the providers. That's another issue. And then this, so those all are hospital issues, and then the first part seems to be more of an insurance issue, a pain out of network and in network, and the definition of what the insurers, when can an insurer look at pain for an inpatient or an outpatient provider versus at the same rate as an inpatient in
You're correct. And that first part, I just, you know, heard from insurers, and some of our hospitals are also insurance, insurance plans. The thing that I understood was what Mr. Savage was talking about. The ACA is going to take care of that. There's language in the ACA that will take care of that. But again, it's a little early to mirror something because they haven't done any rules yet. So it's supposed to take place starting January 14, so I'm sure the rules will be coming along this year. So I think it's a little premature to line it up. Maybe in 12, that would be in February 12 would be a better timing
14,
for that.
You mean 14.
I'm sorry, 14. Where am I?
Okay.
14, that might be better timing.
All right.
Thank you.
Madam
yes,
Chair, if I may.
Please.
Thank you for hearing this bill. I appreciate it very much, and I appreciate Ms. Colby and Mr. Cantrell taking the time to call in on tell their stories. I appreciate the concerns expressed by Ms. O'Sullivan and by the Hospital Association. I do think we need to think about this. I'd like to talk, if I might, with Mr. Savage a little bit more to get his understanding of the provisions of the ACA and figure out whether we need to work to modify this bill this session or whether we can wait until the 2014 session if we think that the provisions of the ACA are likely to address the vast majority of these concerns. So if you, with your permission, I'll work with Mr. Savage to get a clearer understanding of where we might be going with this.
That'd be wonderful. All right?
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 437 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 539. Sandy, would you bring us up to date on this one?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 539 directs the Department of Consumer and Business Services to apply to the United States Secretary of Health and Human Services to participate in the Wellness Program Demonstration Project. Madam Chair, we do have a no revenue and a minimal expenditure impact on the bill.
Okay, so Lou Savage and Courtney Thompson, please come forward first.
Did you want to go down and testify?
Pardon?
Did you want to go down?
No. Okay.
We just going to pass it out.
So
we done?
Yeah.
Yeah,
we can. Why is it logging out so quickly?
You want me to go further?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown here this afternoon for LifeWise Health Plan of Oregon. And I'm going to defer to Lou in a minute and to Courtney in the next minute to explain their role in this. And I do have a special guest with me today, Len Soren with LifeWise Health Plan of Oregon, to do the wrap-up on this. Basically, this bill, Senate Bill 539, is an opportunity for Oregon to be one of 10 states to participate in a 10-state wellness demonstration project that would take place in the individual market where we don't have wellness opportunities today. So this is, again, it's a provision in the Affordable Care Act. It's for 10 states, and we see this as an excellent opportunity for Oregon to participate. So I'll let Lou jump in.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lou Savage, Oregon Insurance Division. Let me start out first by saying that we will not be spending any money on this project. We will not be taking any money from the federal government on this project. This is a pilot project, a demonstration project that is part of the Public Health Service Act, and it creates a 10-state wellness program demonstration project. As you probably know, wellness programs have been around for a while in the group setting, in the group health setting, but not in the individual benefit plan setting. So what this project would do would be to allow carriers on a demonstration project model to see what kind of wellness programs would work. The insurance division would apply for the grant, and we would work in cooperation with the health authority to promulgate rules and to make sure that it was run the right way. Of course, at this point, the project itself hasn't even gotten off the ground, and this only would give us the authority to apply for the grant itself. But we would not have to go back to the emergency board or the Ways and Means Committee because, again, there would be no expenditure of funds.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Courtney Thompson, Government Relations at Oregon Health Authority. This is the first time I've testified. So
welcome.
Thanks. I just want to say on behalf of the Health Authority that we support the DCBS in administering and applying for these wellness grants. We'll be, you know, available to coordinate all that comes with it. The federal government is ready to go on this, and we are here to do it. Thank you. Thanks.
Lou, what's the time frame here?
The project needs to get off the ground by July 1st, 2014.
Okay.
So what I think the reason that the bill came forward at this point is that we want to be in a position to apply for it as soon as it comes out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I mean, educate me for a moment. I understand that we have to have, agencies have to have legislative permission to apply for grants, but why do we have to have legislation to allow you to apply to participate in something that doesn't require any money to change hands? I'm always dubious about putting lots of statute on this that's a one-time situation on the books.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Haywood, this is not our bill.
It's my bill.
Okay, I didn't mean this,
Madam Chair. But.
And we are happy to step up to the plate and apply for Oregon to be a participant in this project.
Madam Chair, I would also suggest that if the legislature has expressed support, it is another feather in the cap when we're petitioning the federal government.
Good point. Okay, yeah. I'm just always careful.
That's right.
Want to be careful about not putting unnecessary statute on the books.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, we passed this bill, then DCBS or the health authority do not have to go before Ways and Means to actually submit and go through the Ways and Means process to have an LFO officer review the proposal and then change expenditure limitation to accept a grant?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I don't believe that's the case. I certainly will go back and check on that, but we are not receiving what is happening with this is that the federal government would say, yes, you can participate in this pilot program. You can be one of the 10 states to participate in the pilot program. But I certainly can go back and check on that.
Okay. Soren.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Len Soren. I lead governmental affairs and public policy for LifeWise Health Plan of Oregon. It's a pleasure to be here with you today, speaking in support of Senate Bill 539. This bill, in our view, will, I think, continue the course and progress that the state of Oregon has taken as a leader in health care reform and the progress the state has made to promote innovative solutions in health care across public and private lines of businesses, specifically related to promoting prevention and wellness programs for individual health care purchasers. And I'll get to that specific issue in just a moment. But by way of background for just a moment, the Affordable Care Act includes the HIPAA non-discrimination laws and the related exemption from those non-discrimination laws for wellness programs in the group market. What the Affordable Care Act did not do was that they did not include an exemption for health and wellness from the HIPAA non-discrimination laws for individual lines of business. That is the gap in the health and wellness world that the pilot program seeks to fill. This leaves the individual market without meaningful health and wellness incentives available in an environment where I think we all anticipate in the coming years post-reform, there's going to be substantial migration from the uninsured population into the individual market in the exchange, as well as an anticipated migration from the small group market into the individual market inside and outside the exchange. So I think we're going to see a substantial increase in the individual marketplace, taking people from environments where they may have had access to group-based health and wellness programs to a health care coverage environment where under the Affordable Care Act presently they can take advantage of nearly no health and wellness programs. These programs have all been very successful in the group lines of business. I think what we see is almost a hierarchy. The best and most innovative health and wellness programs are generally offered in the self-insured market. That self-insured market has operated largely free of many of the constraints that legislation and regulations impose on the insured market because of the nature of a fully insured market. But that has at the same time allowed the self-insured marketplace to really innovate with all sorts of really good health and wellness programs. I can tell you, my company, we have roughly 3,000 employees in three states. And about 6 or 7 years ago, we started a health and wellness journey at the company. And every day I walk the hallways of the company, I see another person who has lost 35 or 40 pounds. I see people walking our campus, taking walking meetings, people lining up for the biometric screening programs, participating in our Health 365 programs. Our healthcare trend at the Primera companies, of which LifeWise is one, has been flat for the last 3 years, in good part due to the vastly increased and improved health state of our employees as a result of these programs that are available on the group level. The individual market can be a lot more challenging than the group market. The advantage you have in a group market is that you can create a culture of wellness, of health and wellness at the company. You can create kiosks, places people can go, meetings that people can attend. There's a group dynamic and a group value that helps drive the success of wellness programs in the group market. One of the challenges that I think the study program will have to address is how to become effective in the individual market, where people are either self-employed, they work from home, or they're at a company that doesn't offer coverage, so there isn't any central, you know, gathering, central energy at the company for a health and wellness program. That'll be one of the challenges, but we think it's a wonderful opportunity, and it's a critical opportunity. I don't think anyone thinks that the increase in health care premiums is going to decelerate any time in the near future. And we believe that health and wellness programs in an individual market, which we estimate will triple in size over the next 3 or 4 years, is really critical to helping us control health care costs. Recent Health Affairs article that I read just the other day demonstrated that health care costs, for health care costs, savings at groups that undertake health and wellness programs are estimated somewhere in the area of $2.35 to $2.40 per dollar invested in health and wellness programs. It's a wonderful investment for companies. It decreases absenteeism. It increases the health state of their employee base. They're generating substantial savings. We think that the demonstration project that the state of Oregon could participate in under this bill would help individuals in the state of Oregon reap those same benefits and potentially earn the same sorts of rewards that are available in the group market, ranging from material rewards for participating in programs to premium discounts. The Affordable Care Act authorizes anywhere between 30 and 50% discount in premiums and cost sharing based upon participation in health and wellness programs. That kind of incentive simply isn't available in the individual market, and if we could get there, I think we could help lower health care costs and improve the health state of individual consumers in the state of Oregon. So thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions you may have.
All right. Is there discussion? In learning about the wellness programs over the last several months, I was really surprised at the financial incentives that are offered by market wellness programs that they are actually proving to improve lifelong health outcomes, and it will and it saves money in the long run, as you were saying. And we are the pioneer, and it would be wonderful if we could be one of those first 10 states to be able to have a demonstration project for wellness. It just fits right in with what we're doing with the health care reform, and this would be for the individual market. And, of course, as Mr. Savage was saying, the applications have to they will authorize this demonstration project, but it has to be before July 1st, 2014. So I sort of wanted to push the envelope here and get us sort of pushing toward that. So that's why the bill was brought forward. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would be happy to support this, but I'm wondering if there's a way that we could somehow require in the bill with a friendly amendment that Ways and Means and the Legislative Fiscal Office would still have authority on approval of the grant proposal and approval of the expenditure limitation. That's, in my experience, has been a pretty good check and balance and an important function of LFO.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I'm a little confused then, Senator Shields, and I'm not trying to be difficult because I agree. I think we do need to be careful, but I think what I've heard you say is that there won't be any money coming in from the federal government to support this. We just have permission to be part of this demonstration project, and that the only money that DCBS or OHA would spend would be to establish rules, the work related to establishing rules around these kinds of programs and what might qualify as an appropriate project under this demonstration waiver?
Madam Chair,
I wasn't being clear. And that it's the insurance companies themselves that would be investing the money in these wellness programs for the individual market. Do I have all three of those
Madam
pieces
Chair,
correct?
Senator, Senator Haywood, that's correct.
Okay, and I'm not disagreeing with you about the importance of oversight, Senator Shields, but I do think that limiting the number of times that the legislature has, I mean, I was dubious enough about the need for this bill, but I think the points about why we need it. I want to make sure I understand why you think it's necessary in this particular case, given that the state's fiscal involvement is pretty minimal.
Sure. Well, DCBS is going to have to apply for this, right? And OHA is going to have to be one of the co-applicants. It's not the insurance companies themselves applying for this. So you're going to have to put together a plan that will require some regulatory work and expenditure of staff time to oversee this, to make sure that whatever the individual market is proposing makes sense and is reasonable, right? I mean, it's going to take you some effort to oversee this program.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I guess if you're asking whether that in itself would create a fiscal impact, no, it wouldn't. We actually do that all the time with respect to grants. So that in itself would not create the fiscal impact.
And we do have a fiscal impact, and there's none.
Right. It's a minimal expenditure.
So maybe I'm missing something. What do you anticipate being in this wellness program, and why do we even need DCBS and the Oregon Health Authority to oversee any of this?
Madam Chair,
the insurance
Senator
companies
Shields.
Just do this without this demonstration project?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, and I think my colleagues up at the table can chime in as well. There are certain requirements for state participation. The programs have to meet certain benchmarks. And I think the federal government is looking to the state to make sure those benchmarks are met. For example, one of the dangers is that if you don't do a wellness program correctly, there could almost be an adverse selection for people who are less healthy. And I think that, you know, in having this demonstration project, the federal government is saying to the state, you need to oversee this.
So Madam Chair, if I could. So I think you're dead on. If there's something that I've seen in the literature around Medicare Advantage plans is when certain groups offer a gym benefit, that attracts healthier people. And so the ones that don't often get stuck with the sicker patients. I do think that LFO, you know, the one-page pony explaining this is what an application, what the application will consist of, could be useful. And then and having a second set of eyes on this, particularly when it is happening when the legislature is not in session. I will absolutely support it. If you prefer not to try to do that, perhaps we can get some assurance that, you know, that LFO would be briefed on it or something along those lines.
In response to that, to me, it would be better that, because there's no money coming into the state on this, this is actually the insurers taking it on themselves, that we could have you come back after the application is done to let us know describe the application or the plan, so to speak. That'd probably be more appropriate.
Madam Chair, this is your bill, but that's what I was going to suggest, that we come back to you and give you a report. We could give you a report both on the application itself and then the results as well.
I would just say I was having a little trouble understanding this, and with all due respect to your verbal testimony, Mr. Shoren, your written testimony is much clearer and explains the situation much better. Now, once I read that, I understood why this bill was necessary and why it was so important for the state to do this because of the specific requirements in terms of how you can do underwriting, if you will, and offer incentives to people to participate. And I think it's great, and I'm really supportive of doing this, and I understand why we need to do this now. It wasn't – your written testimony is crystal clear. I was not so clear from what you were saying out loud, but I understand now, and I really support it, and I think it's a very important thing for us to proceed with.
Thank you. And if Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, if there are any members of the committee that don't have the one page,
it's in OLIS.
It's in the materials. Great.
Yeah,
thank you.
We put it up on the computer.
Okay. Let's go. All right. So is everyone comfortable with having this bill, Mr. Savage, coming back once an application is done and then letting us know? It would be probably September. Would we know by September?
Madam Chair, it really depends upon when we get the publication from the...
Okay.
From
well, yes.
So we will definitely know by the 14th legislative session, and that's probably an appropriate time.
Yeah, okay.
So, Madam Chair, it does occur to me, is this time sensitive? When do you have to have the application in by?
July 1.
So,
of 14.
July 14.
14. July, you have to have the application in by July 1 of 14,
you
know, or you have to start the program
by
July 1.
As the federal government often does, it's a little unclear. The July 14 date looks like the July 1, 2014 date is when the Department of Labor must establish the project. Now, does establish the project mean that it's up and running, or does establish the project mean is it going to get applications out? We wanted to do this now because if they're going to be sending out applications within the next few months, we want to be in a position to apply.
So, Madam Chair, our colleague Senator Whitsitt made an impassioned plea against emergency clauses today on the floor. That being said, depending on the process of getting this through and when it's signed, I worry a little bit, given the 90 days after passage rule provision of the Constitution.
It won't. They're gonna move forward with this anyway. This is just backing up their play, as
and
all this
part
bill
of
does.
The application process.
I just want to make sure you're protected and
no,
you
we're,
have what
I
you
think
need.
We're fine the
okay.
way the bill is. So.
Okay, that's all fine. Right. I just want to ask the question.
Madam Chair, one last question. So just to clarify this, if this bill doesn't pass, you all are still committed to applying for this program?
We're encouraging them to. As a public health nurse, we need to make sure that we're talking them down the wellness program.
I guess what I'm asking, you can still apply without the bill, is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I think the answer is yes. It would be a little strange to apply for a grant that
there was a bill in front of the legislature and it did not pass.
It
would be easier for there to have not been a bill and apply than to have been a bill.
I was going to say, Lou, that's the reality. If this bill wasn't here, they would probably go ahead and do it. For us to defeat this makes it harder for them to do it. So,
but this bill will make it actually easier for you to do it.
Madam Chair, yes, it will.
It will. Madam Chair, I'm just, we have basically a nine-line bill that, God, what's going to happen when we get into the complicated ones? This is what I want to know.
Okay, further discussion. I would like to go into work session. All right, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 539 and open a work session on Senate Bill 539.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 539 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 539 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator, nope. No, I'd like to change my no to aye.
It's good to cover all your bases that way. Okay.
I got it covered.
Yeah,
I got it covered.
Senator
yes.
Steele?
Because this is the chair's bill, aye.
Aye.
Aye, motion carries, and I will carry the bill. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 539 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2089. Sandy, would you let us know what's happening with this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2089 comes from the House Health Care Committee unanimously. It also came off the House floor with 58 ayes, 2 excused, which were Representative Hannah and Jensen. The bill authorizes representatives from either OHA, Oregon Health Authority, and the Department of Human Services to represent either agency in contested hearings. It directs OHA and DHS and the Insurance Exchange to share certain information, authorizes OHA to operate DD programs if the county declines. However, we do have a dash one amendment that deletes all DD references. Yes, and we have the fiscal and revenue on the dash one amendment, and there's no expenditure or revenue impact, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Sandy. Suzanne Hoffman and Jim Scherzinger.
He's been in the building before, I think, one time, haven't you, Jim?
Yes. Yes,
I spent many days in this hearing room. This was the Senate revenue and House revenue rooms.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Suzanne Hoffman. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here with Jim Scherzinger, Chief Operating Officer for the Department of Human Services, to testify in support of House Bill 2089 with the Dash 1 amendments. Just for a bit of background, in 2009, House Bill 2009 established the Oregon Health Authority, or OHA, separate from the Department of Human Services, or DHS. This legislation consolidated addictions and mental health, public health, Division of Medical Assistance Programs, the Office of Private Health Partnerships, the Office of Health Policy and Research, and the Public Employees Benefit Board and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board within OHA. In 2011, House Bill 2100 made additional statutory changes to reflect the creation of OHA. And House Bill 2089 would make additional changes and clarifications to the creation of OHA and its relationship with DHS, further streamlining the functions between the two agencies. So as you may recall, even though we became two separate agencies, we're very closely linked. We share services at the administrative back office level in order to maintain efficiencies, and of course we serve many of the same families in the state as well. So the first thing that this bill does in terms of its housekeeping is it allows OHA or DHS to be represented at contested case hearings by an officer or employee of either department. This change will allow for workload on contested case hearings to be adjusted and streamlined between the two agencies. We have some workarounds in place right now taking care of this, but it's not very efficient, so we're trying to rectify that. The bill also clarifies that when a small estate affidavit must be filed, it can be filed with either DHS or OHA. This ensures that there are not duplicate filing requirements for people between the two agencies. The bill clarifies that either agency can determine eligibility for medical assistance. Currently, DHS makes eligibility determinations through its field offices, and OHA makes eligibility determinations through our central processing center. This just clarifies that both agencies can continue to do that. And with the establishment of the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation, called Cover Oregon, and exchanges coming from the Federal Affordable Care Act, the bill allows DHS and OHA to share information received in applications for medical assistance with Cover Oregon to assist in verifying eligibility and establishing potential tax credit amounts. The bill also clarifies that OHA, as the designated state Medicaid agency, cannot purchase prescription drugs for Medicaid beneficiaries through the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. That's not really a change, but it's a clarification because the health authority now administers Public Employees Benefit Board and Oregon Educators Benefit Board in addition to the state Medicaid program. And those programs do purchase through the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. It also clarifies that it is OHA and not DHS that is responsible for seeking the supplemental rebates for prescription drugs paid for by the Oregon Health Plan and the state medical assistance program. The bill also clarifies the current practice that the two agencies collaborate on staffing a statewide interdisciplinary team to review child fatality cases. Currently, the Public Health Division works with DHS to staff these. And the original version of 2089 did have some language around developmental disability programs. I'll defer to Mr. Scherzinger to talk about the -1 amendment on that. There's some language also in the bill around the Board of Examiners of Licensed Dietitians in the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, and this bill simply amends the statute regulating healthcare workforce reporting to reflect that change. And finally, the bill continues the authority for the two directors of these agencies to delegate duties, functions, or powers as deemed necessary for the efficient and effective operation of either agency. This provision is set to sunset on January 2nd, 2014. And its continuation is needed in order to appropriately and properly serve the clients of both agencies. So thank you for your attention. We'd be happy to take questions. And again, Mr. Scherzinger can talk about the -1 amendment.
It sounds like some of the we have some technical corrections to things that we already thought we had technically corrected.
Yes. Chair Monis-Anderson and Senator Cruz, as you know, it took a fair amount of effort to separate these two agencies and yet keep them together in the ways that would help us to be most effective and efficient. And these are just some things that after the fact we discovered we had not done properly.
It's Tom's fault, basically.
Okay, I would like a clarification of the -1 amendment.
Chair Monis-Anderson, for the record, I'm Jim Scherzinger, Chief Operating Officer for the Department of Human Services. The original language that was in 29 corrected a mistake that was made last session that it inadvertently returned language into the statute that another bill passed that session had changed. You have already actually passed the fix to that in another bill, Senate Bill 22. And so rather than complicate it by doing it again, we just decided between the agencies to suggest just taking it out and letting it ride with Senate Bill 22.
Yeah.
Okay.
We've,
thank you.
We've already been down that road, so we're good.
Right.
All right. No further questions? We have Jim Gardner, if he wanted to come forward.
Right. Do you want Tom back up here? Because he's only been up here once today. So come on, Tom.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, representing Pharma today. I'm just here to really answer any questions that you might have about the OPDP part of the bill, which is Section 6. It was, as was testified, when OHA was created, it inadvertently had the effect of disallowing participation in OPDP by OEB and PEB. That was never anybody's intention. We tried to correct it last session.
Right.
The bill got lost in the hopper somewhere. So,
oh.
And it was non-controversial, but was I don't know why it got lost. But that, this makes that technical correction.
Okay, that helps me because I remember doing that, but it never made it all the way through. Okay, fine.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Nice to come, Tom.
With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2089 and open a work session on House Bill 2089.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 2089.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2089.
Can you pause?
And we need to pause for a moment.
I just want to see the Senator Pinot.
Some things just get lost in the pipeline, don't they? Because, I mean, that's what I was thinking. We had fixed that. Okay.
Okay, Senator Cruz has moved the -1 amendments into House Bill 2089. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, this is a bill I can support.
Okay. Is there any opposition?
Thanks, Chief.
So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2089 as amended by the -1 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2089 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So because this is a House bill and it came to us without the amendments, we have to send in, once we pass it through, then we have to send it back to them
for
reapproval?
It will go back to them and they will concur and
we'll be happy.
And repass
okay.
it.
I'm just getting reacquainted with all the technical work. Yeah.
Or so, if they don't like it, then we'll have a conference committee.
Right.
But chances are
they better like it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Is there any further discussion?
No, ma'am.
Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Sandra Heard.
Aye.
Senator Pinot.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Aye.
Chairman Henderson.
Aye. Motion carries, and Dr. Senator Snyder Hayward.
The lady
I knew you as doctor before you became
no,
a senator. Very hard to change. Would you like to carry this bill?
I'd be honored, Madam Chair. Thank you.
With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2089. And are we done?
We are.
We're done.